Hello, everybody. This is Jake Sensenow, host of Jake and Gino Podcast, with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, you're looking good today, brother. How you doing?
Hey, man, a little teal. This is called teal. It's not blue. It's not light blue. It's not shark blue. It's teal. So I'm doing great for the folks on YouTube out there. Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is responsible for scaling his firm's investment capabilities and has spent nearly 25 years building a proven track record in private equity real estate. So without further ado, Dan Rosenblum, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. And looking at some Miami Dolphin fans here. You guys are both dressed up.
Not a chance. Not a chance. It goes well with my complexion, but I appreciate that. So let's get into this. Please share with us your background and how you got started in real estate.
Yeah, sure. So first and foremost, I'm the chief investment officer at Cadre, where we invest across all asset classes in the United States, looking at real estate investments here. But how did I get started, man? It's been a while. In the mid 90s, I came out of the prestigious University of Wisconsin-Madison's real estate program. So I'm a Badger, proud of it, and came out and went into a kind of a real estate services business, you know, technically speaking, the sell side. So did a lot of asset level dispositions, financing, things of that nature. And looking back on that, I was able to kind of see a ton of transactions. When you're a young professional looking to kind of get into this business, I always tell people, you know, the more deals you see and the more people you interact with, the smarter you're going to become. And so looking back, it was not a conscious choice, but one that I think I lucked into, and spent a handful of years working there before I went to business school. After that, I kind of jumped into much more of, investing up and down the capital stack. So I was with Fortress Investment Group doing debt, mezz, pref, a lot of restructuring. This was prior to the, you know, kind of 08 crash. So, you know, really seeing, you know, the CDOs and looking at the really high levered, you know, real estate transactions that occurred from 02 to 08. In 05, I actually left Fortress and went to a traditional private equity real estate firm here in Chicago, where I invested, you know, kind of mostly in opportunistic real estate deals throughout the US, some internationally. Spent 11 years with them, really growing and, you know, growing out my operator base. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the, I think, most important things is, when I talk about investing, it's 1A and 1B is you're investing in a good market and you're investing with good operating partners. If you don't have either of those things, we don't look at a deal. So once you have one of those two things, you dive in. But we spent a bunch of time, and I spent a bunch of time for about 11 years really developing out my operating partner relationships, learning different markets, investing across the United States in many, many markets. And, I left in 2016. To join Cadre in its infancy and have been there ever since and helped grow our portfolio to, you know, probably right now over $5 billion worth of real estate.
Dan, what makes a good market and what makes a good partner?
we don't have enough time on this podcast to talk about that. I mean, look, I look at things a little bit differently. You know, when we say what's a good market, there's macro and there's micro, right? Just because, let's say I'm going to throw out a market everyone talks about, Austin, right? Austin, Texas is a hot market. It's been hot for a long time, or Nashville. You know, when you look at it, it's, you know, the first and foremost, it's job creation, right? It's, are people moving there? Is the infrastructure in place? And, you know, you worry a little bit about infrastructure in some of those markets when you talk about traffic, when you talk about schools and, you know, police and fire and things of that nature. When you build too quickly, that can really hurt a market. So when we look at the macro, it's understanding not just, you know, how many people are moving there, but what type of jobs are being created there.
Seen with infrastructure problems in the past in markets? Like where have you seen that go wrong and how did that impact you?
Well, I think it's really, if you look at Nashville and Austin are two markets that have grown, you know, quite a bit over the last decade, right? You go there and I love talking to like locals, right? I'll be driving in an Uber. I'll ask the Uber driver, how long have you been living here? One guy in Nashville, perfect example. He's like, I've been here 20 years. He goes, I love the growth, but I wish they could just press pause for 5 years and absorb it. And I said, well, why? He's like, well, we're starting to see more crime pop up and we don't have the police and the fire departments that have grown into the size of the city. So, you know, looking at that, looking at the safety, looking at where, you know, absorption is in terms of traffic is a huge thing, right? Like you look at it, you know, people desirability to live in places, traffic is a huge component of that. And I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles. You can't find a better, worse city for traffic, right? So when you see Austin backed up and you can't get to your office or you can't get to, you know, where you want to go out at night or where, you know, where you're going, during the day. I mean, that's a real big component.
So the solution is just cut out office space and work from home. And that's the solution that we're going to. And that's why office is no longer. It makes sense now. That's actually, when you go down the line, that's the result of it. So don't buy office space. Check.
You know what, Jake? I've over the last 3.5 years, I've spoken to people about office. And I will tell you this. I still believe long-term office makes sense. And here's why.
I think it makes
sense for a couple of reasons. One is, I remember as a young 20-something-year-old professional going into the office and learning from, you know, people who have been in the business and who were experienced above myself. So I do believe that the office component of growth is significant. I also think the collaboration, if I have 5 minutes of downtime between a meeting, you know, if I'm at home, I don't know, I'm looking up sports scores or something, right? Whereas if I'm in the office, I'm going to turn to, you know, Rebecca or to Ryan and talk to them about what they're seeing. And it just, the collaboration is better for the company. It's better for the individual, in my opinion. Do I think the days of going in 5 days a week wearing a suit and tie, which I had to do back in, you know, the 90s? Look, I don't believe in that. I think, you know, Mondays, it's a Tuesday. I'm actually working from home today, but because it's my son's birthday, so I'm here. But, you know, on Mondays, you know, we have lots of internal meetings. I'm at home on my, you know, on my laptop. On Fridays, I'm not going to drive to the city. I don't know if you've been to Chicago lately, but they're trying to redo their infrastructure. It's miserable getting downtown. So I'm here. But Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're in the office. We're collaborating. I think it's better for the young professionals, and I think it's better for the company. And I think it's just humans in general are really, you know, social by nature. And I think it's just good for the health of everybody.
Do the younger kids actually talk when they get a 5 minute break, or are they just go on the TikTok? Is there actually collaboration going on? Do you see it? Like, I'm just wondering, does this really exist? I don't know.
Yes, it does. And it's
okay.
Funny.
When they do speak there, to each other then.
When I'm in there, I saw, it was like a couple weeks ago. I go to New York quite a bit because that's where our main office is. And I noticed that like two of the younger professionals on our team, one was standing behind the other looking at, they have a huge screen, they had a model up, and they're like collaborating and working, going through a model together. And I asked them, I'm like, you know, when you're not in the office, you know, is this what you're missing? And they're like, yeah, like one of the analysts was helping the other analyst, you know, kind of look through the model, and they were working through a problem. And you can't do that from home because you're never going to be able to say, well, let me pop my screen, let me share it. I'm sure they can. Look, I know my kids call me an old head sometimes. I'm 49, about to be 50. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you know, we do things the way we do things because that's probably how we've learned how to do them for many, many years. But I'm sure there's a way to collaborate with sharing your screen and all that. But it's different than when you're talking live, at least in my opinion.
Dan, can you dispel the myth that, especially perpetrated in New York, when you have office space, or we're just going to convert it to multifamily? It doesn't happen overnight, number one. And number two, give me your thoughts about what's going to happen to cities like New York when they were saying work from home, work from home. Oh, now please come back into the office. We need you because the pizzeria is going to close and Walgreens is closing. They're in a big dilemma. Chicago, New York, San Francisco, what do you do? Because you are not converting office to multifamily in 18 months. It takes 18 months probably just to get the permits. And then by the time you do it, you're in another part of the cycle, if you're lucky. So can you speak to that? Because you've been around for 30 years, and I'm sure you've seen people say that over the last 3 years, and that ain't happened. That's a pipe dream.
Right. Well, I think you hit on one big part, which is it takes a long time to design
it's not cheap.
And break down. And that's the big thing, Jake. Look, at the end of the day, it's all about where the lenders want to sell. Because yes, just because I buy a building doesn't mean that it makes economic sense, right? You got to basically, you look at your cost of your land. In this instance, the land is the building that you're buying empty, right? And then on top of that, it's what does it cost to renovate? You know, what's the usable square footage? So a lot of times office buildings can have huge floor plates. Well, multifamily or hotel, when you convert from big floor plates, you know, all that middle space is wasted, right? Because people want the window lines and the long, deep corridors. It's not valuable, as valuable. So the basis has to make sense. Construction costs that we're seeing are not down, right? Like when you look at what's happening in, you know, the development world, and that's redevelopment, development, everything you're talking about, costs are coming down. Labor's not down. Materials aren't down.
I don't know how they can.
No. And so that's the thing. At the end of the day, guess what's happening, guys? You have a kind of a yield on cost that you build to, right? And I'm using air quotes. But then you usually want to have some cushion between where cap rates are today to where you can build. Right now, they don't make sense. Like cap rates have risen 250 basis points, depending on the market, the asset class, over the last year and a half. And, you know, in terms of building, guess what's happening? Rents are coming down and costs are going up on just from the NOI perspective. So when you're looking at your NOI that you're building, you're already facing serious headwinds from both of those perspectives. Don't even get me started on what's happening in the insurance world that's really pushing expense side. But then, you know, your cost to build, it doesn't make sense. It's the risk reward isn't there. So if I'm building something to a 5.5 or a 6 and I can only sell it for 5.25, you know, I'm not taking that risk that spread is there. Like, look, the people who are building, who want to like break ground at A, they're going to look at it and say, okay, A, we believe in the market long term. We think that we can really build this to 6, 6.5, 7. Or B, they're taking a bet that interest rates are going to come down over the next year. That's not a bet I'm willing to make right now. And you know, we're going to wait and see what happens with valuations and how this all shakes out. But I was talking to actually a buddy of mine who I've known for a long time. I won't mention his firm, but he's like the CIO of a huge multifamily company that they own billions of dollars of multifamily. And everyone's thinking multifamily is immune, but guess what? It's not. And what's happening is with interest rates up 500 basis points over the last, you know, I guess a year from that perspective, you know, it's hitting and it's starting to kind of hit all of the asset classes here. And from that perspective, when they're looking at new development or redevelopment, they're putting their pencil down because right now it doesn't make sense given where rents are going, given where expenses are going, and given where cap rates are right now. So you're going to start to see supply dwindle because we were hitting a period of oversupply, guys. Yeah. Guess what's going to happen the next 2-3 years? You're going to see that supply kind of burn down. And then you'll see a bit of a hockey stick, I believe, in 26, 27 in certain markets that have created the jobs. And you'll see some growth back then, but it's really hard to lean into that growth right now.
Did you know the slogan from 2021 was, and I don't know who came up with this, but how many times did you hear, and I'll go back to the air quotes with you, they can't raise rates. That was like the battle cry for people buying bridge debt, right? And going in and pushing this bridge. So how did you guys avoid that trap?
Look, I mean, it's a lot of portfolio construction. It's buying caps. It's sweeping cash flow to take care of your assets that are, you know, that you feel you have real good equity in. It's buying in markets where maybe the market was, and this is back to your question, you know, how do you underwrite markets? Well, there's, you know, there is a macro and then there's micro, and it's buying assets that you think are going to outperform the macro within that market. So that's alpha generation, right? So when we started to see rents in, let's say, Charlotte drop, you know, to 4 or 5% from 10, 15% mark to market, our assets were still doing 10, 12% because we had better assets from the perspective of maybe better location. Maybe we had better unit mix when you look at the overall, you know, micro location and micro asset quality. So we were still seeing some outsized growth on the top line, but we were being defensive. We were sweeping cash flow, making sure that we could buy caps, making sure that, you know, in an interest rate environment that was popping, that we were able to pay our debt service. And, you know, from that perspective, that's the big thing right now is the new coin. I don't know if you've heard this yet, but, you know, stay alive till 25, you know, it's kind of one of those
sounds like a political slogan.
Yeah. Well,
and you know why they're saying that though. And this is what Gino and I say all the time. Just wait till the next presidential election if you need rates to drop a little bit, because you see it every time. Oh, so-and-so is running for president. The Fed is separate from the executive branch. Bullshit. So you're going to see some kind of push downward in 2024. So stay alive till 25. I think that's where that's coming from.
Let me jump in real quick, because that's what the Fed did in 22 in November. They said inflation, I'll use my air quotes, was transitory, right? What the hell does transitory mean? We still got inflation. Dude,
we're 2 years into this now, and it's still raging, right? Come on.
I mean, so let's put it that way. So then we saw that rates weren't pushed because I personally think that they wanted the economy to stay afloat. Then rates go crazy, and in a year span, you shock the entire system. Banks are failing. People are just going nuts. And I think they actually perpetuated that. But not to go down that rabbit hole, Dan, what I wanted to ask you was the markets you're selecting, but not only that, what are the asset classes that you like? Because you said multifamily is not immune. What do you want to stay away from? You'd mentioned hotel before we started the recording in certain markets. What asset classes are you like? I can take a pass the next couple of years.
So here's, you know, at Cadre, you know, we spend the majority of our time looking at, you know, in multifamily and industrial. That said, I've always said in my career that, you know, if you want to invest with good allocators like Cadre, I like to think that I can find good micro deals in a bad macro environment. So I'm not going to say no to anything right off the bat, right? We, you know, because look, we have a roster of great operating partners who can find value and find things in these turbulent markets. But, you know, where we're being very cautious is office and hotel right now. Does it mean we will not buy? No, not at all. Like, you know, you mentioned San Francisco, Jake. Like, look, from my perspective, I grew up in California. You can't replicate the ocean and the mountains. At some point, they'll get it right. I don't know if it's going to take a while. I mean, look, I'm not
going to right politics look right? here. What does right look like?
You know, they're going to want companies to kind of grow there. I mean, look, at the end of the day, they're going to realize there's a tax base. And what's the biggest taxpayer in most of these cities? Commercial real estate buildings, right? Like if you look at my hometown, I live in Chicago, downtown Chicago. We won't talk about the new mayor. We won't talk about all the things, but guess what? The biggest taxpayer in downtown Chicago are people who own office buildings, hotels, big multifamily buildings. And guess what? If values go down, that's going to hurt the tax base and that's going to hurt the economy long-term. And companies are not going to want to be there because people will not want to be there. Guess what? Companies want to be where, you know, the workforce is that fits.
Chicago's got a lot going against it, though, too, because not only are they dealing with the crime and all those issues and the murders every weekend, but they don't have the weather and the beaches and everything. California gets by because you're pinned at 70 degrees for, you know, 8 months out of the year or something like that with the beaches and the great weather. So they have a distinct competitive advantage right there. Chicago, I mean, if I'm looking to move somewhere, they're last on the, like, what is the benefit of moving to Chicago?
All right. Now you're getting personal, right?
You know? Dude, tell me, change my mind. I'm not trying to be an asshole here, but like I've been there. The cabbie told me to make sure not to roll my window down because I might get shot in the face. That wasn't comforting. And so, I'm not trying to be an asshole. I just don't see it. Maybe the food and the Miracle Mile or whatever. I
grew up in LA. I've lived in San Francisco. I've lived in New York. I've lived in London.
So you've seen some shit.
I've been around from that perspective. And I will tell you, what are the benefits of Chicago comparatively? Well, look, you can buy a house for about, you know, one-tenth the cost you can in like Los Angeles for the same house. You pick up my house, you put it in, I don't know, you go put it in Santa Monica, you go put it in Pacific Palisades. It's worth 5, 6, 7 times and you can't afford it. So, you know, there is an affordability matter.
They've created an affordability opportunity. Got it.
That said, I will tell you, look, you know, for what I do, where I travel a lot, being centrally located, having the, you know, O'Hare, the infrastructure from, you know, airport, trains, things like that is phenomenal. And look, like Chicago, you know, people are like, oh, it's going to become the next Detroit. Here's the difference between Detroit and Chicago. Detroit was one you know, sector, right? It was automakers was driving Detroit. Chicago is very, very diverse from that perspective. And like, I look at it and say, okay, at the end of the day, if I'm a company and I'm putting my, you know, flag down, what I look for, I want people to come, smart people, energetic people. And look, the affordability is important.
So you go to Boston.
Okay, let's put snow away. Oh, well, Boston's got, you know, Harvard, MIT, you know, BC, BU. We've got all of the Big Ten. We've got, you know, the University of Chicago, Loyola, DePaul, like Notre Dame. You know, the schools that are within a 3-hour drive of Chicago is, I would rival any other city.
You have heritage and legacy that's keeping it afloat, it sounds like, is what you're saying.
Well, there's infrastructure, there's costs.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you have the existing that's keeping it alive. Yeah.
Look, there's something you want to live in. I'm not going to sit here and deny that. Like, so my best friends, they have a daughter who's 23 years old. She went to Indiana. She grew up here. Guess what? She's living in New York City. Most of her friends are going to New York City. They're going to Austin, Texas, even. They're going to, you know, L.A., not so much. But, yeah.
Miami?
Look, you know, you want to keep it here. Miami's a different beast. I think, you know, that's an interesting commentary, like, for South Florida. There are a lot of people here who have moved
well,
there.
Well, I feel like they've drawn a lot of the L.A. out, where, like, 10 years ago during, like, the whole, like, remember, like, Entourage was so cool and L.A. was the scene. I feel like a lot of that's got pulled down to, like, Miami now. It's got a little more hip of a vibe to it for the younger folks, right?
Yeah, I think
LA's... Gino and I aren't hanging out there because we can't make it past 10 anymore. But, you know, I think there's a certain group of folks that they prefer that. You know?
Dan, let me ask you a time... One second. Yeah, let me
Gino's like, I got to break this shit up.
No. Let me ask you about California, because this is important, because I'm trying to think long term. Minnesota, they had problems with their supply and demand. They got rid of their zoning and they started actually building. So rents came down. What's going to happen to a state like California where you can't build? You still need supply. There's a lot of demand, but there's not enough supply. And Jake, by the way, you know the show Air? Nike closed their main factory from 84, their main store in Oregon. Can you imagine that? Like, these companies are leaving. I mean, Nordstrom, 30 years in San Francisco, they're leaving. Walgreens are closing up. I don't know, how do you reverse that? And prices are still going up, and they want rent control. Rent control doesn't work because there's not enough supply in the market. But you can't build in California. It's too expensive and it's very hard. How do you fix that problem, that imbalance in California?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I have an operating partner that we own a deal in Salt Lake City with. They're based in Southern California, and most of what they're doing, they're trying to do more affordable housing in Southern California because it's a huge problem. First of all, to your point, land costs a tremendous amount. And then we talked about it. Like, at the end of the day, you can only – like, these developers aren't doing it pro bono, right? So they either have to charge rents that are going to make them money, or they're going to have to get subsidized from the cities, the counties, the states, in order to create, you know, rents that are affordable for these people. Because at the end of the day, guys, like, as much as supply and demand does, you know, kind of push values in these cities, at some point affordability becomes a governor, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it's not,
yeah,
I mean, look, California and New York have always been much higher percentage of your, you know, your income goes to rent than, let's say, Dallas or Charlotte or Atlanta, for that matter. But, you know, it's catching up. I mean, one dynamic which was interesting during about a year ago, and it's changing now, but it was the first time in the U.S. where the average rent in the Southeast was higher than the national average. Well, what does that mean? A lot of people were moving out of California, New York. They were going to Southeast, and you know, Southeast used to be affordable from that perspective, right? Atlanta.
So I live in Tennessee, and I just visited San Diego, and the minute I got home, everything was 50% off. So while it has gone up, it's an immediate 50% discount on everything from gas to groceries. Crazy. Right. And so there's still a huge affordability. It's just you would go in some of these towns in, you know, Tennessee where 10 years ago rents were $500 and now they're $1,200.
Well, that's the problem. That's a problem.
Everywhere else in the world has had rents at $1,200, and it's still, the rent share per wallet is still very reasonable. So it's just it's kind of caught up to the rest of the world because of the influx of folks moving to those areas.
Yeah, look, it's all about the job creation, guys. Like, you follow the jobs, and you know, you need the infrastructure spend in order to kind of keep people there. Because at the end of the day, like you say, like, look, why Chicago? Guys, restaurants, sporting venues, entertainment, bars, things like that. You know, that's why when New York, everyone's like, oh, New York's dead. New York's not dead. I go to New York, you know, quite a bit. It's not dead. Because guess what? There's phenomenal food, phenomenal entertainment. People like that vibrancy, and the young people are always going to gravitate toward those markets. And that's going to keep these companies really, you know, kind of wanting to be there and having flags there. But that said, what we saw during the pandemic was, and we actually were investing in deals where in markets, like secondary markets, like Charlotte, Nashville, and things of that nature before the pandemic hit, because we just thought that in terms of having employers put flags where, you know, talent is, made sense. Well, guess what? The pandemic accelerated that. So yes. Like Oracle, for example, right? Oracle, what is they're based in San Francisco. They have their presence there. obviously the pandemic hit, people are, you know, commuting, or, you know, who were commuting are no longer doing that. And they were like, well, you know what? I could go work in Charlotte and still work for a company in San Francisco. Or I can go to Nashville. And guess what? Oracle's like, you know what? I'm going to plant a flag there. Oracle bought a bunch of land just north of the river there. And they're going to put their, you know, they've worked on a deal with the city, and they're going to put about 10,000 jobs over the next 10 years there. And, you know, that's something that's really changed the dynamic and the landscape of certain cities within the United States. But look, I love Nashville, not knocking it at all. But like, Nashville's infrastructure in terms of restaurants, in terms of nightlife, stuff like that, when you compare it to an LA, a Chicago, San Francisco, New York, like, it's just not there yet. It will get there eventually. And people want to be there. But why do people want to be there? Maybe it's the sunshine. Maybe it's the affordability when you compare it to San Francisco. You know, maybe it's, you know, you want to buy a house and the school systems are better there. So, you know, you're having kids, but people were having kids later. People were, you know, moving to the
It's simple though, because you get decent weather. It's not like San Diego weather, but you get decent weather. It's pretty damn good. You get extreme affordability, no state income taxes. Pretty solid nightlife. It's becoming like the Vegas of the East Coast in a way, you know. So if you want that sort of thing, and there's the sports teams, not on par with a New York or LA, but I think you get enough of that to get some stickiness and keep a lot of people there. So that's, I think that's the, you know, the attraction there.
No, 100%. Look, you know, there's no doubt from my perspective that people will move. The reality of it though is, you know, you have to have an almost be a full generation switch, right? Because generally a lot of people like to go back to where they're from. You know, they're comfortable. They know, you know, it's communities they grew up in. There's friends there. There's family there. So, you know, to pull them away from all that, you do have to have, you know, low income tax. You have to have things that are going to draw them there to say, okay, this makes sense. I'm starting my family. This is where we're going to plant our roots. And, you know, these cities, what I love about it is, you know, I think the next second tier of cities are catching up to that top tier in terms of population, in terms of what they offer. And then also the, you know, obviously we joke about it, but you know, the working from home component, it's not necessarily working from home, but it's working from other cities other than the kind of the hub, right? So knowing that, hey, I can advance my career in Nashville, but, you know, even though in the hub in San Francisco is where, you know, the majority of the C-suite is, but I can still kind of advance my career. That's important. And I think that's something that has really helped catapult some of those cities. And then you're right. Like, look, the restaurateurs, I mean, like Miami has, you know, totally changed its landscape in terms of restaurants, things like that. All of New York's moved down there. So it's becoming a mini New York from that standpoint. Yes. But why do you live in a place? Your point, first and foremost, like, can you afford it? Secondly, the weather, you know, obviously jobs, things of that nature. But then ultimately, as you get older, and that was the thing that we saw, was this generation in their 20s, now going into their 30s, they had kids later, they were getting married later, so the suburbs weren't as attractive. Well, guess what's happened now? You know, pandemic hit, these urban cores were kind of shut down, and you're right, crime has hit. Just looking in Chicago, the suburbs had a massive revitalization.
Look at Jersey.
Week. Yeah.
The exodus out of New York to New Jersey was huge. Yeah.
Well, you go, just look here. Look, I live on the North Shore of Chicago. Every town has been revitalized, basically restaurants. And like we literally joke, like on Friday, Saturday, we used to go to the city. Now it's like, well, why go to the city? We have the same restaurant 10 minutes from my house.
So they opened up their second location to make it convenient for you. Yes.
Exactly. It's like, okay, I don't want to go down to the city. It's just a longer Uber ride or, you know.
Mario's got a place down the street. You know, it's a second one. So we're doing it.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over 250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, BuyRight, ManageRight, and FinanceRight.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Build Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey in multifamily.
Dan, before we go to short answers, you had mentioned about market cycles, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, because maybe showing your age, you said you've been through three market cycles and everyone is different. What's it different about this market cycle right now that you see as opposed to the previous one we went through?
Well, okay, the previous one, I mean, there's a look, at the end of the day, in 08, 09, it affected every asset pretty similar, right? Like, it was a capital stack leverage disaster. This time, the fundamentals in different asset classes, whether it's industrial, multifamily, hotel or office or retail, it's affecting it very differently. So you're seeing different outcomes. Now, that said, the other big difference was, if you go back to 06, 07, some of the huge leverage buyouts that happened, whether it was Hilton, whether it was, you know, equity office properties that, you know, Blackstone obviously famously bought both of those companies. Well, guess what? They bought them with a ton of debt. And at the time that they bought it in 06, 07, LIBOR and, you know, treasury rates were closer to 5. And so what happened in 08, 09, where a lot of people were able to kind of maintain and you know, kind of kick the can, so to speak, was LIBOR went to 0. So interest rates went down 500 basis points. Whereas today, interest rates are up 500 basis points. So you not only, you have the double whammy of, you know, kind of rents coming down, fundamentals getting hit. And then on top of that, your interest costs are going up exponentially. I mean, that's across both, obviously, residential and commercial, for that matter, right? So, you know, a lot of people are kind of like looking at this, looking at our lenders saying, hey, we need some help here, we need some relief. But, you know, until lenders kind of reset, it's going to be hard to figure out kind of where values are, right? Like for office, for example, you know, it's kind of a disaster. I mean, I think it's from the perspective of, you know, what is an office building worth? Well, you don't know, because at the end of the day, unless you're buying it unlevered, you know, there's not a lot of lenders out there who are willing to take some chances on debt. So until the lenders kind of get back in the market and we can kind of reset values, transaction volume is going to be down significantly. And, you know, it's down 50, 60, 70%, depending on the asset class in the market. But we need to see some transactions start to happen for us to get some pricing transparency here. And so, you know, where is it different? It's ultimately the fundamentals. When you look at multifamily, for example, you're looking at it saying there's still a lack of housing in this country. And we talked about it, like, you know, whether it's affordability, whether it's, you know, you know, kind of moving around, you know, whereas in 08, 09, people were stuck in mortgages and didn't have the, you know, kind of the mobility to move from Detroit to South Carolina for a job, right? Like home ownership in 08 was close to 70%. Today it's close to 60%. So you have this, you know, mobility today that you didn't have, you know, 15 years ago, which allows certain markets to outperform other markets, right? Like, so, you know,
I think it opens up more competition among the markets in the States, which I think is a great thing, because it's people are buying and, you know, basically buying their city now or buying their state. What can you do for me? And I'm going to go there who offers the most value. The interesting thing about this market versus, say, you know, 2020 to 2022 is that, so Gino and myself are actually buy and hold investors and we don't raise capital. So from 2020, say, to 2022, we were, you know, doing maybe 100, 200 units a year. And we slowed down quite a bit because it wasn't really conducive to our model. And this year alone, we've done 3 deals. And so we've actually become more active, because what we'll do is we'll buy loan to cost with, say, a credit union, right? And then maybe we're at 6.5%. Well, we'll stabilize that on the loan to cost based on, say, we're buying and the rents in place are $900, but we know based on internal data that the market is $1,200, right? If we can make that work, we'll suck it up on, you know, IO for 2 years and then get it out to agency, you know, maybe 5.5-6% or something like that in our underwriting.
Yeah.
And it's working out. So it's more of like you know, we're buying the boxes on a construction model, right? Because we're going to go in, we're going to fix them up, and hopefully to stabilize where we believe the market rate is going to be. So we've actually been more active, but I think it all depends. Are you a capital raiser? Are you buy and hold internal capital? There's, you know, different, the cycle lends itself to, you know, different strategies. So I think that's, it's actually kind of helped us a little bit in all honesty, which is, I think we're sort of like an outlier there.
Yeah. Look, I think, you know, if you're, it depends on the size, right? Like, you know, one thing we look at is, you know, these big $1 billion funds go after assets that, you know, equity checks of north of 50 million. If it's less than 50 million, you know, it's not, it doesn't make sense for them to spend the time and the resources on it. And then, then there's under $15 million where it's a lot more, you know, kind of local mom and pops or, you know, the country club, so to speak, you know, kind of pass the hat.
You can, that's where you can find the value though.
You can, right?
with the poor operators.
Where we play is that $15 to $50 million equity play place. And that's where it's too expensive for that person to pass the hat, but it's not, you know, large enough for, you know, those big multi-billion dollar funds to go out.
And we're in like the 5 to 20.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like that 5 to 20. And so there's opportunities there more now than we've seen, which has been great for us because it's, you know, you like to be active.
Yeah, no, look, 15 to 50 is where we like to play. You know, historically, when you look back, it actually, when you kind of bifurcate by size, it tends to outperform the other two, meaning the smaller and the larger deals. So we like to play there, to your point. There's not as much competition. But at the same time, what we're concerned about right now, what we're watching is, you know, buying at kind of like, you know, negative leverage, right? So you're buying for a 5 cap and you're putting, to your point, agency debt at 6% on, you know, you got to be very, you know, cautious here. But, you know, if you have conviction, to your point, that you think rents are really 1200 when the, you know, when the assets, you know, charging 900, that mark to market you think is really 25, 30, 35%. That's significant. We're not on the institutional quality real estate where, you know, kind of, you know, 200 plus units.
It's different.
It's harder.
You're not seeing that.
You know, for the five.
Well, because they're going to be closer to market, if not at market, right?
Yeah. Look.
Or if attempting to get beyond. So that's where it's, that's why it's not there potentially.
Right. And then also the other component, like when we go look at deals, it's, you know, you're looking at, okay, there's a couple different metrics that we're looking to generate, you know, outsized NOI. One is that mark to market you're talking about. Two is, do we think that, like, you know, the previous owners, you know, from an expense side, do we come in with a good operator and we think our NOI margins can be a lot better and more efficient because we own more units or whatever the case may be. But then the other one is the capital inside the units. Like, you know, we love when it, you know, an asset hasn't been touched for 10, 15 years. There's real upside to put, let's say, $5,000, $10,000 into a unit and see return on investment on that capital at, you know, 18 to 20 to 25%. Now, we saw over the last 2 years an anomaly where we were seeing 30, 40, 50% on that capital. And we were seeing mark to markets, you know, in some markets like Tampa, we were seeing 20% mark to markets for doing nothing. That's obviously really kind of slowed. So when we look at buying a 5 cap, it's how quickly can you turn to positive leverage? One of the new recent acquisitions we just made was actually in Charlotte, where we assumed a loan that was about 8 years left in duration, and it was a 4% fixed rate loan. So day one, we bought it for a 5 cap. We were positive leverage. There's, guess what? There's cash flow we're distributing to kind of delever the asset, but also de-risk our equity capital there. And we like that. Now, those deals are few and far between. But, you know, look, the people who have access to cheaper debt are going to be better off right now. You know, the high net worth family office that decides to go buy a deal because guess what? They can put up other collateral to a bank. And instead of getting a 5.5-6% loan, maybe they can get a 4% loan. We're seeing some of those transactions.
Still wouldn't love that.
No, yeah. I don't love it because you're cross collateralizing and that's your other assets. We don't do that. You know, we're
cross collateralizing and like floating debt is the stuff that would keep me up at night.
Yeah, look, we have two kind of funds. We have a value add fund, which is more 3 to 5 year holds, which will do more floating rate debt because you want the flexibility on exit. But then we have a longer core plus, what we call a horizon fund, which is longer dated, kind of what you guys are doing, right? We want to buy and hold.
Yeah.
We like to think over a 10-year period of time, we're going to create value half through asset appreciation and half through cash flow. And to do that, you know, it's much more, to your point, fixed rate debt, you know, longer term from that standpoint. And, you know, there's creative ways to kind of figure out how to generate some cash flow. Right now, those are tough because you got to get sellers to kind of agree to selling at cap rates that, you know, maybe they didn't underwrite. And that's why transaction volume is down so much right now, is that unless you have to sell, you're not selling. Like, again, that person I was talking about, they own billions of dollars of multifamily. Well, they have an open-ended fund structure where they have redemptions. They got to sell some assets right now. So he told me they've been selling some stuff, you know, core stuff, you know, that, you know, again, it's, you know, he's like newer stuff or stuff that's just been renovated. So not a lot of capital needs. And he's still selling those at like kind of sub five caps to big institutions. But those big institutions may have access to cheaper capital from on the debt side. Or to his point, he's like, look, they're buying into interest rates coming down over the next 12 months. Because if you look at the curve right now, you know, the forward curve is telling you that in 24, you're going to see interest rates reduced. Now, I'm not going to say whether or not that's an election year or not. That's for you to tell me. But yes, interest rates.
You said it.
Interest.
Dan, it's actually for the history to tell us. Like, we look back at history and it's very, I mean, it's just so obvious. I mean, like, we don't, it's really, and both sides do it. I'm not going to say one side or the other, because I'm Trump supporter, but he should have raised rates. He held rates back, and then COVID comes, and then obviously cat's out the bag. And if he had slowed the economy a little bit and done his due instead of going to the Fed and making it that way. So both sides do it. This is just to stay in power and to stay. So, and I see in 2024, when it does happen, we're going to have to, because I think a lot of this residential stuff is going to get backlogged. People ain't dropping prices. There's not, it takes a little time for real estate residential brokers and lawyers and title companies to feel the pain. But when you're down 50, 60, 70% and there's no volume, they're gonna have to drop rates. There's just no other way. You can't go from a $2,000 mortgage to a $4,000 mortgage payment in 12 to 18 months, and people aren't buying. So they're gonna have to. They're just gonna have to. You know.
Well, look, to come full circle, you asked how this is different than the last time. I think the last time, the majority of the reason why we had a downturn was the capital stacks were just totally destroyed. Right. It was more of a capital markets issue here. Multifamily, we're talking, it's more akin to what happened then, because we have a capital markets issue potentially, but the fundamentals are still very strong. You know, when you look at industrial, when you look at multifamily, then there's office, and it's just the biggest question mark is what we talked about. We joke, but you know, how are people going to use office going forward? Does it change? I think there is probably 10 to 15, 20% on the bottom that, you know, becomes obsolete. And at some point it gets cheap enough where you can convert it, you know, tear it down, whatever you want to do. But, you know, people joke, well, you should just tear down these offices. Well, you know, there's an owner there that has a vested stake. And until it becomes owned by the first mortgage lender, that's not going to happen. Right. So, and that's a fundamental disconnect between what happened, you know, 15 years ago to today, is the fundamentals for office are very, very challenging. And look, there's a top 10 to 15% in most markets that are great. Like the true trophy class A plus office buildings that have these amenities, people are going to those buildings. The building actually, you know, it's funny, we talk about Chicago, our office is in Fulton Market. Our building has a waiting list because it's one of those buildings. It has a basketball court on the top. It's got, it's phenomenal location. But that's one of probably five assets in Chicago that are full. And so from that standpoint, you're going to see the bottom, depending on the market, 20, 25% become obsolete. That it's that middle 50, 60% that I'm like watching closely to see, okay, how does that kind of bounce back? And it's going to have to reset from a pricing perspective. And what we're seeing right now is what happening also in 10, 11, 12. Guess what? Lenders are taking back keys from every, you know, everybody's doing it. But, you know, guess what? And when they go sell those assets, they're giving seller financing. So there's a deal right now that is in the market, you know, an office building where, you know, they're basically saying, hey, look, you know, come in, buy it. You know, it's maybe it's a 10 cap, maybe it's a 9 cap, maybe it's a 12 cap, but we're going to give you, you know, 2-to-1 leverage at, instead of where like a lender, first of all, there's not many office lenders out there, but if there were, it'd be at 8, 9, 10% cost. They're saying, we'll give you a 3, 4, 5% loan at 2-to-1 leverage for 5 years, because guess what? It's smart for them because, you know, they're going to get their, some of their equity back, you know, in terms of the lender from that sale. And then they're going to say, they're going to kind of have a hope note and say, okay, we're going to put this money out for the next 5 years. Hopefully values come back and we get that money out. If not, we take back the keys again, and then we kind of reset and figure it out from there. That's going to happen, and it has to happen. And you talk about transaction volume. I always say, like, have you ever been to ULI or, The National Multifamily Housing Conference, like, you know, it's either in Orlando or Vegas or LA. They're huge. There's tens of thousands of people. You look around, you go, all these people, you know, their livelihoods depend on transactions happening. So it will start to happen again, but it's going to start from the first mortgage lender, the first position, lien position holder, to basically be able to say, okay, we're going to start lending again, or we're going to take back the keys, we're going to reset value. And then that's how it's going to kickstart transactions again. But we need the transactions to give transparency to valuations, to give people comfort to lend. So it's like, it's kind of one of these, you know, chicken and the egg, or, you know, kind of questions. It will happen. We're starting to see it kind of flush through the system a little bit now. It's going to take some time. But we expect prices are going to remain low for some time until we see, you know, really that turn in transaction volume. And then, you know, look, the other huge difference, guys, to 09, 10, I don't know if you remember that, not a lot of dry powder there. There's billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines right now waiting for this. But it shifted, mm-hmm. right? So if you had $2 billion in 09 versus $2 billion today, I will tell you it's different because the allocation to, again, going back to office, all these institutions are going, leaning more toward multifamily and industrial. So there's even more, if you look at $2 billion, it's not created the same because it's going after a different asset class today than it was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, like I talk to a lot of people in the multi world, I think at 5.25, 5.5 caps for institutional quality real estate in, you know, kind of like markets that, you know, we all consider pretty much core, there's so much money there that there's a ceiling to how, or I guess a floor to how low values could go, because people will jump in at those and there's a lot of money waiting for it to happen.
So to summarize this, what you're telling me is that the person that figures out what to do with office is going to be the richest man in America.
I think there's going to be some bets, and you got to, like, when you're looking to allocate your capital to people who are investing in real estate, it's all about risk adjusted returns. Look, in 10 years, someone who bought San Francisco office is going to look like a genius. It doesn't mean that 20 other people tried and didn't fail. They failed, right? And it's timing, and it's, and, you know, so look, it's all about being prudent about the risk that you're taking. And I look at real estate investing more about, you know, growing your wealth as opposed to kind of taking these VC type bets. And, you know, there will be people out there who can make a lot of money buying, you know, an empty, you know, convention style hotel in XYZ city or an office building in downtown San Francisco. It's not there yet, but it will happen and they'll look really, really smart. But I got, you know, it's funny, everyone looks up, you know, in those environments. Go look down. There's probably 20, 30 other people who failed at that. And that's why, you know, we want to be prudent about building a portfolio that will create value over a long period of time. That's what's really important about building wealth within real estate. That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. So start to wrap it up here. Tell us about your firm and the ways folks can.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said earlier, so, you know, the way we look at ourselves is we're institutional quality investors, where we have the ability and through our platform to allow people to come in who might not have access to institutional quality investing, whether that's, you know, kind of investing alongside institutions who are investors in our funds, or, you know, looking at the team that we have, you know, starting from, you know, our investment committee all the way down to our analysts. You know, we have a process in place that is much more akin to a private equity real estate institutional investor. And what we do is we allow through our platform at cadre.com people to come in and invest alongside these institutions and have access to, you know, building out wealth through these portfolios. And we have, we've created kind of two different vehicles. One's more, like I said, a value add, which is our Cadre Direct Access Fund 2, which you can go online at cadre.com and, you know, invest into that fund that we're right now taking, we're raising capital to invest over the next, you know, call it 3 years. And then we have also kind of a Horizon Fund, which is our more of a core plus longer dated fund. So that's more lower returns, but longer holds, creating value through price appreciation as well as cash flow. Whereas the value add fund is probably looking at much more price appreciation through buying, you know, in a distressed environment. A lot of real estate, when you look back, people have made money, and you look, you know, it's a lot about vintage. And we're coming into a time period now where it's probably a good time to have dry powder and look at where the markets are. And over the next 2-3 years, you know, you can be buying, you know, quality real estate below replacement cost, where, you know, you think the fundamentals are maybe good to strong today, that they're going to get better over the course of 3 to 5 years, where we think, you know, it's higher IRR, but lower duration. So, you know, those are kind of the two products we're offering right now on our platform. And, you know, we feel very strongly about our track record. You know, we've been around for 8 or 9 years now, and we've delivered for our investors, and that's our long-term goal.
Awesome. So the website is cadre.com, and Gino is going to wrap us up here.
So you have Dan, who in the 90s was a Badger, went to work as a real estate service company, went to Fortress. He's a traveler, California, Chicago, New York, London. Jake, he likes to get on the plane, Jake.
He's got some watches, I bet. I bet this guy's got some nice watches, you know.
He's a jet setter. And the cool thing is, in 2000, all you need is one, baby. And in 2016, he joined Cadre as the CIO, Chief Investment Officer. And what I like about their firm is they are partnering up with great operators, number one. And number two, in really good markets, understanding the dynamics of a market, not just looking at the market from a fundamental perspective, but looking at it long-term. Is there infrastructure in that market? Is there a desirability in that market? Is there affordability in that market? And is there a plethora of different types of jobs? You don't want to go to Detroit where you have one company out there, one basic, you know, auto manufacturer, they leave and you're done. So all the work that Cadre has done to go out and take a look at these different operators in these different markets, if you're wanting to get into these institutional type assets and you can't do it, just go to cadre.com, take a look at Dan and his company, and be sure to do your homework. But I like their business model. I like the way they're investing, and I like the due diligence and the work that they've put into their model.
Well said, Gino. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G Daddy, and we make it happen. We'll see you next time.